Really exciting. Well, what I'm going to try to do today in a brief time is just talk a little bit about where the microwave background field has been. And the history part, what I'm going to try to do there is to convince you that some things have now become easy to do. And I have to convince you of that, or you'll never believe the second half of the talk, because what we're setting about trying to do now is much, much more difficult. So if the first part hasn't become easy, then we're in big trouble. So for this audience, all I have to point out is that when we're observing the microwave background, we're looking at a photosphere, which is present only a few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang. And if you think that's a long time, the analogy I like is that it would be equivalent to imaging David, for example, 5 hours after David was conceived, when he was still a single cell. And so we really are looking at the embryonic universe. And after matter combines to neutral form here, all these photons, to very, very good approximation, don't interact at all for the next 14 billion years till they end their lives in our telescopes here. The other thing that, just to note for general background, is that these photons, which were due to the annihilation of matter and antimatter in the early universe, that radiation field, those photons, still outnumber by a vast degree all of the photons that have ever been emitted by any astrophysical object. Right? So from a physicist's point of view, we can ignore all this complicated stuff and planet formation and all that. We just want to study this. So here is to test your ability at analogy. and you guessed it. All right. This is what the microwave background was predicted to look like in the flat universe, which is consistent with inflation, and it evolves to this. The Hubble Deep Field, where really the most distant galaxies that we see in this field, is what I would call the toddler universe. It's probably equivalent to David when he was about age 2. But it really is true that what we're looking at is equivalent to this. And much as the biologist could tease out the DNA in this and figure out whether that cell was going to grow up to be the Kavli director or not, the trained cosmologist can decode a lot of information from the microwave background map. Okay. So what are all those little hot and cold spots in that map? In fact, I should back up and I should say that this map, which is a map of the whole sky, is a map of very small temperature variations on the whole sky, typically of order 100 microkelvin or so on the 3-degree background. Right, so what causes that? This field is interesting really only because the physics that is behind those temperature variations is, we believe, very, very simple. And I think you'll be convinced of that if you haven't already been. And so what's happening is that as an overdense region tries to collapse in the early universe, it's before this stage where the CMB decouples from the matter. It's very tightly bound to the matter. And the matter is very tightly bound to the radiation. And as a result, if an overdense region tries to collapse, it builds up pressure, and it will, in fact, bounce. So these are the so-called acoustic oscillations in the early universe. Very schematically, there is a maximum size which has time to maximally compress once before the radiation is released from the matter. And that gives me a standard yardstick here. And the simplest thing to understand that we get out of the microwave background observations is the measurement of the geometry of the universe. And we all know now that the geometry has been measured very accurately to be flat. And we get that measurement just by comparing the physical size of this, which we can calculate quite simply, with its angular diameter on the sky. This simple picture also predicts a series of harmonic overtones, smaller and smaller angular scales, on which you'll also see increases in the amount of power on the sky. And this, I show this, this is now a historic picture, or historical. This slide was relevant probably as little as 6 or 7 years ago now. And COBE, of course, detected the first structure on the sky. So this is power on the sky versus angular scale, multipole moment here, so large scales and small scales. And COBE, with its resolution, was sensitive to just this range of angular scales. And until we had more data than that, all of these models were allowed. They were simply normalized by the COBE measurement. And you see the characteristic first so-called Doppler peak, and then a series of harmonic tones. And if the universe is flat, then this first peak occurs at an angular scale of about a degree. Right. So I'm going to show you an extremely parochial selection of data, experiments I've been involved in. This is the data as it existed now a couple years ago. So here's data from a balloon-borne experiment called Boomerang, these blue points here, and then another experiment called Archeops, also a balloon-borne experiment. And if I add the theory to guide your eye, you'll see that it's an astoundingly good fit. Of course, there's probably about 10 free parameters to that fit. But there is very, very clear evidence, even in these data sets, of not just the first peak, but of harmonic overtones. And we can see a couple of them in the data now. And that's pretty much how things rest. There are experiments that are attempting to measure these subsequent tones, and I'll speak a little bit about those. Okay, and then this is also data from the interferometers, notably CBI, DAISY, and VSA. It's a completely different technology. And these also turned in evidence of multiple peaks here. And then also CBI out here, you can see there's a couple points that begin to lie off of this theory. Okay, and that's very interesting. In fact, it's the only departure in all of the data that has been gathered, I think, well, to pretty good approximation, you can say, with the many, many experiments that have been done in this field.
What about the low alpha?
What about the low alpha? we can talk about that. I think it is arguable whether that is a statistically significant departure. But to take a broad view, dozens of experiments have been done now over a few decades. And even as the precision has gotten tighter and tighter and tighter, the experimenters, all of them, have been doing a very, very good job. Because in the end, there haven't needed to be any huge revisions. These are
in the error bar, the IL, would you consider that to be really significant given the number of fields they've looked at?
Sure. So there's a paper out. It might be Goldstein et al. I've forgotten now. But there's a paper out that analyzes the data here, not just from CBI, but from BIMA and from ACBAR. And I'll speak about that in a moment. And it's borderline. It's kind of a 2-point something sigma effect, one that could easily go away. But it's really quite interesting. The curves that I show here indicate what would happen if we were beginning to see the first hints of what is called secondary anisotropy. So this curve here, right, is its genesis is the flat power spectrum that was initially laid down in the inflationary epoch, and then modified by this acoustic oscillation process during the first few hundred thousand years in the universe to give you these bumps. But at some point, what I said at the very beginning of the talk, the fact that the photons have not interacted at all with matter since E of 1000, at some point that approximation breaks down. And we know that in clusters of galaxies, there's gravitationally bound ionized gas. And some of the photons, order 1%, that actually go through a cluster, actually scatter on those hot electrons. Because the clusters are typically on arc-minute scales, and remember, this is a degree, that power winds up out here, right? So it's small angular scales. And you get varying amounts of power depending on the amount of structure in the universe, a measure of the abundance of clusters, for example, and their richness. And so parameterized in terms of sigma 8, which measures the amount of power on scales of 8 megaparsecs, you'll see that the amount of power you get is a very strong function of this parameter sigma 8. In fact, it goes like sigma 8 to the 7th power. And what that means is that when we are able to accurately measure this, and separate it from the primary spectrum, we'll get a very, very accurate measurement of sigma 8, and one on a very large distance scale. So I think that this is a very exciting place to be working right now.
Andrew, my memory is weak lensing is already ruled out 1.05. It's 0.8-ish in weak lensing, right? It can tolerate.
That's true.
Okay.
That's absolutely true. So what's, I mean, if you ask me personally, what's the most likely outcome of this, right? Well, you wind up around here, which is consistent with the data today, but it's going to drift light. So, but, you know, we have to see what happens, okay? All right. Now, of course, the best measurements of the power spectrum now on most angular scales have been done by the WMAP satellite. And I show this just as an example of the fact that really all of the experiments that preceded WMAP were done quite well, and they're in very good agreement with WMAP. So this is the WMAP data points here are the little black dots. They've been binned to match the binning just in terms of L space of the boomerang data. And the red points are the boomerang data. And what you see here is that WMAP makes exquisitely accurate measurements here at low L, where the precision is dominated by how much of the sky you've covered, right? But experiments like Boomerang and others, which have higher angular resolution than WMAP, can actually do better here at the high Ls. Right? The WMAP data is continuing to pour in. These points will not become any more precise. That's the cosmic variance limit. But the points here will become more precise, although not by huge factors. Okay, so now I want to convince you that generally, as a field, experiment aside, Bill's group, my group, the WMAP team, whatever, that we've gotten to the point where we can really do this with high signal to noise and we can do it accurately. So this is the data from the Boomerang flight, which was in 1999, 5 years ago now, almost to the day. And it was released first in 2000. And if you were to take a bit of sky like this, even from the WMAP data, and you were to flash between the various frequencies that they look at, you could see similarities in the maps, but the signal-to-noise in any given point isn't very high, right? With Boomerang, because we focused just on this one area of the sky, which is an area which is about 3% of the sky, the signal-to-noise actually gets pretty high. And so if I flash between 150 gigahertz, for example, and 240, right, and you watch the parts that stay the same and the parts that change, what do you see? Well, out here, you see at 204 gigahertz a lot of relatively bright structure, and that's because this line is a plane that's 10 degrees off. This is a line that's 10 degrees off the plane of the galaxy. Right. So the galaxy is very, very bright here. It's brighter at 240 gigahertz than at 150 because you're seeing thermal dust emission, and you're starting to see that come out. Okay. The other thing you'll see is that generally on the edges of the maps you'll see a lot of bouncing around because we don't have as much integration time there. Okay. But if you look at structures like this in the center of the map, then they're quite stable. And the other fun thing to look at is if you look in the middles of these circles here, right, you'll see little red dots that wink on and off. And those are all quasars, which are at redshift of about 2 here and here. And it gives you a real visceral feel for at what level astrophysics starts to inject itself into the process, and we have to actually take into account. Obviously, at this level, there's very, very little power in this whole map, which is being contributed to these quasars, which are among the brighter in the sky. Right. So that's the kind of the state of measurement some years ago now. To give you another comparison of kind of how well we're doing in terms of the fidelity with which we can actually make maps, here's another representation of the Boomerang map. See those quasars again. Here's the WMAP map, just that one section of the sky. To be fair to WMAP, this is 3% of all of its data. And you see the quasars there too. This is at 90 gigahertz, that's at 150. The maps look remarkably different. And you say, wait a minute, which is right? And that's because there's a lot of spatial filtering in this map. We can't be sensitive to very large scales with Boomerang. But if I spatially filter them the same way, so here's WMAP and Boomerang, then they start to look quite similar. And in fact, if I look at the average of the two and the difference, you can see that even these two experiments done at different frequencies with very different methodologies, and one of them, in fact, hanging on the end of a rope over the Antarctic, pretty accurately see the same sort of thing. Okay, so that's all history. And what you also see here, and I'm assuming most of this audience is quite familiar with this, is that we've really reached the age of precision cosmology, where the microwave background measurements, in combination with other measurements, like large-scale structure, supernovae, have allowed us to determine these basic parameters with relatively good precision at this point. And we hope in the future that these numbers can get more precise by factors of 3 to 10. Okay? And the great frustration with these numbers is, for the experimentalist, is they are exactly what the theorists told us they should be before we did the measurements. So I remember quite distinctly running with this, at least this list of numbers, right, up to my division chair at Caltech, and I said, "Tom, bad news, it's a pure vanilla universe." And he said, "Oh, you mean lambda zero?" And I said, "Aha! We've taught at least some of the lowbrows something."
All right. Andrew, your parentheses errors in 0.99, which are four.
So this is the
four and last digit.
Right. That's right.
So 1.3 and 1.3 and the age.
This, okay, so this is 13.7 plus or minus 1.3. The others are all in the, right. Right. Okay, so where are we going in the future? Well, the first thing, well, one of the things that's about to happen is, much as a whole generation of ground-based experiments led up to WMAP, experiments like Boomerang, Maxima, Archeops, have developed another suite of technologies and methodologies, and they're leading up to something called Planck. And Planck will have better angular resolution, much better sensitivity, but most importantly, much better control of systematics than any of the suborbital experiments. And it'll be able to do some things remarkably well. And I'm going to return to Planck in a moment, but I want to set it into the context of a bunch of experiments that are going on, the vast majority of them from the ground. And you can, if you look at the future in the field, you could choose to split it into two main categories. One I've already mentioned, which is to push out to very high L. But by pushing out to high L now, we're doing something qualitatively different than just trying to make a more precise measurement of the primary power spectrum. We're going to be doing astronomy, which frankly is too complicated for me, so I don't think I'm going to be doing much of this. But the characteristics of this is we'll be studying the universe at redshifts of 1 to 3. The signals are fairly big. If you look at one of these clusters, you get a change in the microwave background temperature, which might be of order 100 microkelvin. So that's big. But they're typically an arc minute big, and that's been beyond the resolution of most all microwave background experiments to date. But it will not be in the near future. So what you need to do this is you need a big telescope, 8-10 meter class dish, and you need very high mapping speed. And so, as I'll mention, there are at least three, if not more, projects which are being built now, which will be fielded in the next couple of years, which will employ large arrays of bolometric detectors on kind of 10-meter class telescopes. And there's all kinds of science that's going to come out of that. We're going to learn a lot about cluster physics. If we're really, really successful in that, you can perhaps begin to put some constraints on the equation of state of the dark energy. So I'll mention a few of those. Where I'm directing my focus these days is a completely different field, and that is CMB polarimetry. And the attraction here is that if we're exceptionally lucky and everything goes just right, we could, in fact, probe the epoch of inflation directly. I think the chances of that happening are very slim, but the prize is so great that, at least if you have tenure, it's worth doing. Here, the signals are going to be tiny. They're going to be less than 100 nanokelvin. And that's why you have to believe that this microkelvin stuff is just a slam dunk now. All right? And I can say that at the tens of microkelvin level, it's not quite at the level of an undergraduate lab experiment. But it is true that pretty much all groups can go out, build a machine, make the measurements, and get consistent results. Okay? This is orders of magnitude fainter, and it's going to be a real, real challenge. And I'll try to speak to a few of the aspects of that. The good news is, although the signals are very small, the signals we're really interested in are on large angular scales. They're typically a degree. And because all of the telescope size in this business is driven by diffraction, that means that if I choose the right frequencies, I can use a small aperture. In fact, I'm going to describe an experiment today that uses an aperture which is only 25 centimeters big. So it's a very, very small telescope. The nice thing about a small telescope is you can hope to really control it, right, and understand what it's doing. All right, so move on. So things that are, this is a plot now of frequency, electromagnetic frequency here, with 100 gigahertz here and 1,000 here, and spatial frequency here, with, again, large angular scales and small angular scales. And every experiment lives somewhere in this space. So for example, here is COBE operating between about 30 and 90 gigahertz, but only sensitive to angular scales corresponding to multipole of, you know, 10 or 20 or so. Right? MAP, which is returning data now, subtends this much of the space. Okay? And then there's a whole bunch of other experiments on here. I want to draw your attention to this dashed blue or turquoise line here. Okay? And this indicates the sweet spot where it is believed or now known that the measurements are least confused by emission from our galaxy. Okay? And, you know, just in case you're curious, here at large angular scales and low frequency, this would be synchrotron emission from the galaxy. Here would be radio point source emission, right? And here's point source emission from dusty galaxies, and here's dust in our galaxy. So this is what bounds the problem. But you'll notice that as I go to higher and higher spatial frequencies, smaller angular scales, the sweet spot makes this marked turn upwards, right? And so this is one of the reasons why this new generation of telescopes that's being built is being configured with receivers that typically operate at about 150 gigahertz. Versus the kind of 40 to 100 gigahertz, right, which has been typical at these larger spatial scales. Of course, the other reason is that if I can do the measurement at 150 gigahertz instead of 90, my telescope aperture is that much smaller, right? And that's a big driver. Right? So I show this in one of my popular talks to indicate that for physicists, anyway, particularly those of us who are not officially astronomers, this is a very comfortable part of the universe to operate in. And afterward, things, of course, get much more complicated, to be sure more interesting, but much more complicated. And I'll leave it up to you to guess how far down this list you can still calculate things. And I'm not sure where that is. I'll just say a couple of words about the Sanyaev-Zeldovich effect, because you'll be hearing a lot about this in the years not so distant. These new class of telescopes, some at South Pole, some in Chile, will be going online from 2 to, say, 5 years from now. And their real target is this effect, which is the scattering of the CMB photons in the hot intracluster plasma. And when you do that scattering, then what's happening is you're preserving photon number, but as the CMB photons propagate in, they run into electrons, which are much, much hotter, and they scatter up in the frequency. And if you do a differential measurement and you compare what you see looking through the cluster with what you see in the surrounding sky, the spectrum of that looks like this. It's actually a decrement. Here's data from CBI looking at a number of clusters. And the sky looks dimmer in the direction of the cluster, right, down to some frequency, which is, or up to some frequency, which is 217 gigahertz. And then, if I were to repeat the measurement at higher frequency, this would look brighter than the surrounding microwave background sky at higher frequencies like this. It's basically photon diffusion from low frequencies to high. This frequency is remarkably insensitive to the temperature of the electrons because they're all very, very hot. And the neat trick is it's also completely independent of redshift, because the increasing temperature of the microwave background as I go to high redshift just compensates, right, for the redshift effect. And so what this series, or what these telescopes should be able to do then, is to measure the effect with high precision. Most of them will be operating here, so they'll be seeing a decrement. One of the first things you'll do is you'll establish the number density of clusters on the sky, and you should be able to do a census in terms of redshift depth, which is very complete. Right? And the reason is that, unlike any other effect in astrophysics, the surface brightness of this effect is independent of redshift. Right? It's independent of redshift because, as you go out in redshift, the microwave background is getting brighter in the scattering rest frame just as quickly as the surface brightness would be decreasing. And that means that if you can resolve the clusters, it's just as easy to see one at high redshift as at low redshift. This is unlike all other kinds of astronomy. That is neglecting evolution of the clusters, of course. But if you take the same unit cluster and you put it at any redshift, then you can see this at any redshift. And so this should be a quite an orthogonal way to get a census of the number density of clusters as a function of redshift without running into the kinds of selection effects that optical and X-ray astronomers do. This is one example of a telescope that's operating right now at South Pole. It's very, very modest in comparison to the machines that are about to come online. It's a 2.5 meter dish, Viper, which is was built by Jeff Peterson some years ago. And there has been a new receiver put together by Bill Holtzapfel and John Rule, which contains just 16 or so elements at a variety of frequencies. And the data from ACBAR looks roughly like this. And so you can see now that ACBAR is able to go out, because it's a larger dish with better angular resolution, to higher spatial frequency. And there is no hint yet in the ACBAR data of any excess, but it has not reached the precision with which we can disagree with the CBI excess. Right? So all of this data was obtained with these detectors, which are bolometric detectors. And I'm not going to, with this audience, I'm not going to go into the details of how these detectors work, except that you can tell just from the picture that these detectors are lovingly handcrafted one by one. Okay? This is not optical astronomy yet, where we have CCDs of millions of pixels. You have this funny silicon die that takes enormous amounts of work to process, and then you mount it in here, and it's a little tip of a pen here to give you scale. But it's about 5 millimeters across here or so. And you can build up arrays of, you know, focal plane arrays that look kind of like this, but you're never going to scale that to 1,000 pixels. And that's important to remember for what's about to follow. Right? But one thing that ACBAR, we hope, will be doing this season and in the next season, and it's going to be very hard to do, is to try to tease out this secondary anisotropy. So here you see, given all we know now, what the primary anisotropy would look like if it's the only thing there. And then here's the secondary anisotropy here, if the CBI result is correct, right? And then here's the sum of the two. So this is very, very difficult. Look, we're way down in power from the peak here, and we're going to be trying to tell the difference between perhaps this and this, or this and this. These are the CBI points, and this is what I'm assuming for the fit of the secondary spectrum through the CBI points. So it's high. It's probably about sigma 8 of 1.05, but CBI observes at 30 gigahertz, and because this effect is frequency dependent, when we compare with ACBAR, which is at 150 gigahertz, it scales down by this amount. If we looked at 217 gigahertz, we wouldn't see the effect at all.
All right. But are you assuming that most of the CBI result is from SC or is from radio galaxy?
This assumes that it's all from SC, right?
And why would you see much less at 150 gigahertz?
Because in these units of temperature rather than delta Y, the SC effect is less bright at 150 gigahertz than it is at the CBI 30 gigahertz. So that's a funny thing you have to do. It's a little confusing.
You mean that angular filtering is not an issue?
Well, the angular filtering is taken into account in these error bars. You see, that's why the error bars are becoming bigger here. This is where we run out of room with Akbar's 2.5 meter dish. We run out of angular resolution there. So it's a strain. I mean, this is going to be difficult to do, but we can attempt it. Now, this is hard to do from the ground. One experiment that will do this really, really well is Planck. And you can see that here, there's a pretty picture of Planck. And this is the precision with which one hopes Planck can measure the temperature power spectrum. And it's going way, way down into the tail here. And what is not shown in here is the fact that Planck will do this at several frequencies which are on both sides of that null in the SC spectrum. And so what we'll really see with Planck, okay, is at 200, there's a channel that's right on the null of the SC effect. And that channel is blind to secondary anisotropy completely by design. And it will measure the true primary power spectrum. And then by comparing that with channels on either side, we'll be able to, I think, very, very accurately measure the amplitude of that. Okay. The other thing that Planck will do, which is shown here, is it will measure the polarization of the microwave background. And I will say, and Phil will probably agree with me, that when I say Planck will do these things, there's a little hidden caveat, and the caveat, little footnote reads, if it works, okay? And that's because these machines are very, very complicated. And they're difficult to make work properly. Planck involves, for example, in one of the instruments, cooling this large focal plane of detectors to 100 millikelvin on orbit. And unlike WMAP, which was designed and executed by a very tightly integrated team of about a dozen people and associated engineers, Planck is being designed and executed by a committee of, say, 100 people or more spread between 12 or more countries. And so I think Phil and I have the same perspective on this. For those of us used to building an experiment like this in a lab, this is a terrifying experience. So we'll see how it comes out. all right. This is just to show that that this is a terribly old slide, but just to show that Planck falls short of the angular resolution at about 5 arc minutes that you would need to actually resolve these SC clusters out to any redshift you choose. But what you need is about a 6 meter or greater dish at 150 gigahertz. And this is kind of a precursor instrument that's going now. You see we've taken one baby step towards larger arrays. So this is the same kind of spider web detector that we've used on Boomerang and other experiments. But now they've been put into monolithic arrays, and we can get up to kind of hundreds of detectors this way. These particular detectors are operating now on the CSO, and that's an effort being led by Sunil Galwala and Jason Glenn. And the South Pole Telescope is supposed to have light around 2006 or so, and is supposed to have a 1,000 bolometer array on it. And that's a big challenge to try to field. This is obviously an enormously difficult and complex thing to try to build and run down at South Pole. Okay. So now I'm going to turn to what I find most fun and interesting from an instrument building point of view. And who knows? I mean, it might pay off. I mean, it really is hard to say. So this is, I think, out of Alan Guth's book on inflation, and it shows you radius of the universe as a function of time if inflation happened, and it looks now from all this data as perhaps it did. Just to point out that when we measure the anisotropy, we're only probing back this far in the age. The spectrum measurements, you know, go back to about here, right? Kind of order of a second after the Big Bang. And it's possible, if nature is really, really kind to us, but we've been lucky so far, that the polarization will allow us to probe all the way back to the epoch of inflation itself. Some people will argue, I think Paul Steinhardt is among them, that it is natural that the signal should be big enough for us to see. And others would not argue that. But let me just tell you what we're doing here. So the microwave background is polarized, and it's polarized by a quite prosaic mechanism, which is mildly interesting, but not really worth all the effort that we're going through to measure this. And the reason is we're looking at Thompson scattering here from the surface of last scattering, and if there's a quadrupole moment in the sky at that point, then the radiation I see in this polarization has been scattered off that electron from this direction, and in the other polarization off the electron from this direction. So if these two directions have different temperatures, then I'm going to see a polarized signal. That's really simple physics. And so it turns out that by measuring that type of polarization, we can learn a lot, which is of a similar sort of information and somewhat complementary to the temperature power spectrum, because we're probing the same epoch. If you ask what the power spectrum of this polarized radiation would look like, it's the curve labeled grad here. And it's called grad because Thompson scattering will produce a polarization pseudo-vector field, which if you did vector calculus on it, would have zero curl. So we call it the grad term. And it would have a spectrum like this. And in fact, the DAISY experiment has detected this signal kind of around this angular range. It's just barely a detection, but it's the beginning of what will rapidly become an activity to measure this power spectrum as well. You can see it's quite a bit dimmer than the temperature power spectrum. So it requires us not only to build a polarimeter, which is much more difficult than a radiometer, but also to have very high sensitivity. You'll see this this upturn here, right? And this is what the map results have told us, that the universe apparently has a significant optical depth in scattering after recombination, because it appears to have been reionized, perhaps at a redshift as early as about 20. And that causes more power to appear here at large angular scales. And this could be very, very important for the ultimate goal of what I'm going to describe, right? So that's all interesting, but the really interesting part is this, that if inflation happened, depending on the energy scale, there is a certain amplitude of gravitational wave background in the universe today. And in very superficial terms, since those gravity waves have helicity, they can distort this polarization vector field, and they can produce a distortion which has net curl. And that power spectrum is one where we can pretty confidently predict the shape of the power spectrum. And as you can guess, this is about the highest it could possibly be, right? Given current models for inflation. And if the energy scale were lower for inflation, this signal could be much, much, much lower than this, right? So the idea, the program here is, in order to detect a direct relic of inflation, not just circumstantial evidence, we want to detect the gravity wave background via its imprint on the microwave background. And that imprint is a relatively small distortion of a very small polarization signal. And these are in microkelvin squared. So this is 1 microkelvin. This is 100 nanokelvin. And this is 10 nanokelvin. So we're down in the kind of tens of nanokelvin regime here. To make matters still worse, it would be nice if the only thing that could produce the signature of polarization field with curl in the CMB, if that only thing was the gravity wave background from inflation, but it's not. Lensing from compact objects also does the same thing. And so not only is the signal very, very small, but we have to try to distinguish it from what might be a foreground confusion. So the good thing, the good news here is, if you want to make a career in this, it has legs. And this is going to take a long time to do. All right. People will tell you that Planck has a chance of detecting this gravity wave background. Here it is on my very own view graph. And what we see here now is a temperature power spectrum, this EE spectrum, the cross spectrum between temperature and the grad, which is what MAPF has detected, right, through here. And this is the signal right here that Planck is going to try to detect. And these error bars are what you would naively calculate the sensitivity of Planck would be on that signal. Okay? You can see it's a tiny signal. It's not many sigma, even if everything went perfectly well. And there are lots and lots of things that can go wrong. Just to give you a graphical impression of how difficult this will be, here is what the sky would look like. I think this is about a 30-degree diameter patch of the sky. So it's similar in some respects to the field we looked at in the boomerang maps, a little bit smaller. And you see the temperature anisotropy, now well known on these scales, plus or minus 200 microkelvin. You also see all these lines, and those indicate the polarization field, where a line this long is a signal of about 3 or 4 microkelvin. Okay? Now, if I turn off all of the effects of the gravity waves, what I get is this. So what I have to do is I have to tell the difference between these two pictures. And if I use the color, I'm cheating. Because the color, it's true that the tensors contribute to the temperature anisotropy, but not in a way that we can separate from the primary anisotropy or from the gravity wave background. And so what I need to do is tell the difference between these two pictures looking only at how the little lines change. Okay? This is not an easy thing to do. Right? This compares MAPF and Planck and their abilities to do this. And the important point is that Planck is not, nor is MAPF, designed to be a polarimeter. And if you talk to anyone who builds astronomical instrumentation and describe to them how these missions attempt to do polarimetry, they'll give you a very funny look, because it's not the right way to do it. Right? It's being done at some level successfully by the WMAP team because they're very clever, but it's not the way you want to do it. Okay. The most important thing you want to do when you do polarimetry is you want to be observing both polarizations in a single beam, and you want to modulate them quickly, chop them between two detectors. This is a device which was invented by an unspeakably smart graduate student in my group named Bill Jones. And Bill is graduating in a year. Right? He invented this his first year in graduate school, and it is being now put into the Planck focal plane. So that was quite a contribution that he's already made. What he did is, in terms of, he just took the spider web bolometer that we use to do radiometry. He figured out a clever way using a corrugated waveguide to carefully control the fields, so that even through after all the optics, a linearly polarized input signal has a field distribution in electric field that looks like this. And then what you're looking down the throat of this, are actually two bolometric detectors. You can see one of the thermistors lurking here at the edge. And you see this cross pattern. One of them has grids like this and one like this, and they absorb only along those grids. And so you just suck the two linear polarizations out of the waveguide with very high purity. So that's nice. It's a beautiful piece of E&M engineering. And Bill, for his thesis project, has put them on Boomerang. And Boomerang flew again just about a year ago. I'm going to just show you a teaser plot, but this is the team. Here's Bill. It's cold even indoors working down there. And this is the example of why this last flight was the last balloon I'm ever going to fly. So this is the altitude versus time during the flight. It's supposed to do this. These are diurnal oscillations. We bounce up and down about 10,000 feet every day. That's okay. The sun's always up, but it is going up and down since we're flying about 12 degrees off the South Pole in latitude. But it's not supposed to do this. And it did this for 4 days, and we all scratched our heads, and we convinced the guys who are flying the balloon to dump all the ballast. And it just kept doing that, and it finally kept getting worse. And right around here, on the 12th day or so of the flight, I was reminded that there is a feature in the flight train that automatically cuts the balloon down, cuts the payload down if you drop below 65,000 feet in altitude. Why would you have that? What flies at 65,000 feet? A U-2, right? So this is so you don't hit all the U-2s that are flying over the Antarctic. Right. So we were forced to terminate the flight. We normally launch from here, and we like to go around in a big circle and come back to here, which we did the first time. We were forced to terminate here, very close to a place called the Pole of Inaccessibility. This is a pole, you know, the U.S. claimed the geographic South Pole back in the Cold War days. That's why we're there still. I mean, we're doing a lot of great science from there, but it was a Cold War thing. The Russians, not to be outdone, claimed two poles, Vostok, which is, I think, near the geomagnetic South Pole, and the Pole of Inaccessibility, which is the place which is furthest from any beach on Antarctica. And I think to this day there's still a big bust of Lenin out there somewhere. They actually had a post there, a bust of Lenin and our payload. And so this is our actual track because we were descending. And this is actually a flyover. We had a beautiful landing, and the payload froze the parachute froze to the ground, and there's Boomerang. And it was actually recovered just 2 weeks ago. But we got the data back a year ago. So we've been looking at data, and these maps will look familiar. This is actually raw data coming down just during the flight. And this is what we do if we get the sum of the two polarizations and the difference. So you see that even in the really gross sense, the detectors are doing what they're supposed to do, even where you get very bright emission from the galaxy here, it pretty much disappears. You see a couple knots left there. Those are actually bright, polarized dust clouds emitting from the galaxy. Right? And I'll just show you a little teaser. So this is the state of the day analysis right now. And what we did is we went very, very deep on about 100 square degrees of the sky there. We covered a much bigger part of the sky, too. And we covered a bigger part of the sky because we're going to get our calibration off of WMAP. And we need enough overlap with them to do that. So we spent a few days on a much bigger part, and then the next 10 days on this deep part here. And what can you see? You can see structure in the microwave background, which if you have a very good memory, you will remember these exact spots, bright and cold, from the map I showed you at the beginning of the talk. They're the same spots. The morphology agrees precisely, and that's wonderful. Then you'll see this hash out here, which is the fact that we have really poor signal-to-noise on polarization out here, because it's such a small signal. And then you'll see the hash, you know, go away, and you have these nice little bars here, okay? And then you'd be led to conclude something which you shouldn't, as much as it would be kind of fun. We're used now to looking at maps of the temperature which have high signal-to-noise. This is new. Back in the COBE days, you looked at maps, there was only statistical information. Okay? Let me guarantee you, right, that there is no high signal-to-noise measurement of polarization anywhere in this map. Right? But we may and should be able to tease out statistically, right, what the power spectrum of the scalar mode of polarization looks like over a reasonable range of L in here.
What's the noise? Resolution.
I'm not going to say a number because I honestly don't know it off the top of my head, right? But I can tell you that the signal to noise is not far off what would be necessary to do this, right? So this is a comparison of what WMAP and Boomerang should do on temperature cross polarization, right? And where the WMAP are the solid lines here. And so what we hope to be able to do is to get a measurement of maybe two bumps if we're lucky, right, in that spectrum. It's hard to do, and there's no guarantees yet that that's going
to
happen.
Can you also go to higher L than the previous Boomerang
flight? That also remains to be seen, depending on how well the attitude solution goes. Okay, but here's the thing that I most learned from this flight of Boomerang is before we launched the balloon, we just stared up at the sky for weeks at a time, and we had these polarized bolometers instantaneously differencing the polarization along a single beam. And even from McMurdo, from the ground, when you difference them, the signal got real clean. And obviously, you can do this from the ground. You don't have to go to a balloon. And you really want to do this from the ground. And I know Phil is going up to White Mountain, right? And it's the CMB polarimetry is going to proceed, I think, most fruitfully, not from balloons, and maybe not from satellites, but from the ground, because if you build the right kind of system, you can difference out this atmospheric emission very, very well. So, in the last few minutes that I have, I'm going to describe one or two such experiments. And this is the one we're working on down at Caltech now. And this size of this thing, this doer, cryostat here, is about so high. And this is, as Brian Keating likes to say, the first refracting telescope for cosmology since Yerkes. What we have here is we have a telescope where the primary optics are lenses which are cooled to 4 Kelvin. Right? The detection that MAPS made to date, that's the cross power spectrum of temperature and polarization, the correlated signal, which is up here. But MAPS should be able to pull that out and also to make detections around here. Planck should do a pretty good job, very, very good job up here. And then as we come down here, this corner of the plot gets more and more difficult for Planck to access, because not only is the signal lower, but it's on larger angular scales. And that's where the systematic effects are going to trouble Planck. And then you see here what we hope to be able to do, for example, with BICEP and with QUEST. And these should be taken as illustrations of the things you could do from the ground. I'm sure that if you properly design an experiment using different technologies, like a large focal plane of HEMT receivers, you can do similar things. And so I think the path forward in this field is going to be by ground-based experiments which are operating either from South Pole or from the Chilean desert or from White Mountain, and that we have an awful lot to learn. Because we have to go from barely being able to make a detection here to being able to do vector calculus on signals that are way down here. And that's gonna take a long time. There's been a lot of talk about something called CMB pole. I think the prospects for CMB pole took a real big hit about a month ago when NASA was realigned to go to Mars. I don't really see how this fits into that plan. There is, maybe someday there will be an experiment that is follow-on to Planck. And the question is, how would you possibly get more sensitivity in that? And I'll just end by saying that it's going to be very difficult to get more sensitivity, but that efforts are underway now to build large focal planes using very, very different techniques that could give us about an order of magnitude sensitivity improvement over Planck. This is really hard and expensive to do, and it's not certain whether the funding is going to be there in the current climate. So I think I'll just end with this slide, and the point of this slide is to say occasionally, rarely, the experimentalist here, this is Hubble with his pipe, have to teach the theorists something that hasn't proven to be the case in the first round of imaging the CMB, but it might prove to be the case in the future. And I'll stop there.
Just a few quick questions, because we've got to clear the room for the platform.
We were talking about Stafford's too, but there's all excellent thoughts. On the systematic side, we often argue in the field that we have to do this and that because it's some vague notion that we have to get low systematics. But in fact, what history has taught us is that most of that was wrong.
Yep.
And in fact, what we need to do is just go do it.
Yep.
And now, the argument for low systematics, of course, is good because one can ask for money, satellite,
yep,
whatever, because you got to do it that way. But in fact, I think a lot of us that are in the ground, literally in the trenches, would say, you know, the reason MAP succeeded was because it had $400 million of money to succeed, not because it was at L2. And
yep.
I wonder what your feeling is. You know, we're basically going back to the past in what you're showing here, I mean, back to ground-based astronomy.
Yep.
And
well, so my feeling, I mean, I'm voting with my feet. This experiment, right, is designed to go for broke quickly with lots of sensitivity and see what we see. And see, you know, the first thing we need to do is understand how big the foregrounds are. Fine, so we've only got two frequencies here, but, you know, that's enough to get a spectral index out of. And the thing is, rather than trying to do this all by pure thought and launch a billion-dollar thing, you do something cheaply and you make progress. I'm going to guess that such things cause a gravitational radiation at much higher frequency than we are sensitive to here. But Lars can probably correct me.
That's got to be right.
Yeah.
Be right.
See, both, right? So spatial and temporal frequency. Right. So this is the why. I mean, for example, LIGO could in principle do this, but they're way, way down on the wean tail of this, you know, spectrum. Yeah.
Great. Thanks.